Hello and welcome back to the second part of this two-part episode on trace fossils with Professor Tony Martin of Emory University. If you haven't already listened to part one, then why are you listening to part two first? If you download our podcast through our feed, then the first part is 14A and the second part is 14B. And if you're listening to us on paleocast.com, both parts and all the supplementary images can be found together under the episode 14 title. So having just discussed the advances in technology that are helping ichnologists study trace fossils, which included sending the eminent ichnologist Dov Sailaker to the bottom of the sea in a submarine, whether he likes it or not, we rejoined the conversation with John picking up on something Tony had mentioned earlier in the episode.
You mentioned archosaur burrows. So for people who don't know, archosaurs are crocodiles and birds and everything in between, including dinosaurs. So what are some of the kind of archosaur burrows which we found in the geological record or the fossil record?
Not that many, surprisingly. That's something that I had the great luck, and I do throw luck into it, the great luck of working on what's probably the best known, best documented dinosaur burrow from the geologic record. That was discovered by David Verrecchio, who I mentioned earlier. He's at Montana State University and Museum of the Rockies. The lucky part of that is I'm old friends with Dave in that we went to graduate school together at the University of Georgia. He did his master's there. I did my PhD there. We went to a lot of the clubs together and saw some pretty cool hardcore bands while we were there in Athens, Georgia. I could talk about that for days. But Dave and I stayed in touch. Dave took an ichnology class with me at the University of Georgia, and he never forgot that sort of connection to trace fossils. So he recognized that there was this probable burrow that was attached to where they found this small ornithopod. And Yoshi Katsura, his colleague who's in Japan now, Yoshi first saw the bones. So they started looking at the bones. Dave saw, that looks like a burrow. Then he contacted me. He was very cheeky. He sent me a picture with almost no information and said, what do you think of this? And I said, that looks like a burrow. He's like, well, I was hoping you'd say yes. And then he revealed that there was a dinosaur at the end of it. So you can imagine the happy dance that happened on my end. But it took us a while. It took us nearly 2 years. I went out there that same year. I dug out the burrow with him, and we documented it very carefully. What was cool was that there were these little commensal burrows coming off of it, which I predicted ahead of time. I said, if this is a real dinosaur burrow, or if it's a real sort of large vertebrate burrow, it's going to have little burrows coming off of it, whether those are from insects, mammals, or whatever else is living down the burrow. That's something we see nowadays with modern gopher tortoise burrows, alligator dens, and other large vertebrate burrows. Is they have a lot of a lot of critters living down there with them. Okay, so that's something to think about with respect to looking at these larger suspected burrows in the geological record. So we did document that there was a small burrow that was appropriate for, say, a mammal, and then a cluster of burrows appropriate for, say, insects, coming off either corner of this twisting tunnel that was filled with sand, and it had a dinosaur at the end of it. Oh, yes, I omitted something that was potentially important. Yeah, there were two juveniles in the burrow chamber with the adult. Oh, yes. Oh, did I mention they were the same species as the adult? Oh, yeah, I keep forgetting these things. Yeah.
Slightly important information.
Oh, yes.
Which species were they?
Yeah, the way I describe it to people, it was like a Christmas on a holiday on your birthday sort of thing, as far as discoveries go. We had the burrow. There was an adult dinosaur. There were juveniles in the burrow with it. And then when Dave looked at the anatomy of the dinosaur, which was a new species, that was another bonus there, Oryctodromius cubicularis. When Dave looked at the anatomy of it, he saw that it had a fused premaxilla. It had a fused scapular coracoid, had a large acromion process. I know I'm talking dirty now.
Yeah, I don't think many of us.
People are going, ooh, tell me more. Please tell me more. Okay, but it also had 7 sacral vertebrae instead of the typical 6 you would have in an ornithopod dinosaur of this size. Well, all 3 of those were great adaptations for a burrower. So that was pretty cool. The fused premaxilla, for instance, that was the snout being able to use that for digging, a little bit of a shovel sort of thing. A lot of burrowing vertebrates do that. They get their snout into it. Fused scapular coracoid, for instance, there were good attachments there for digging muscles, like we'd see in modern armadillos. 7 sacral vertebrae instead of 6 in the hip. Ooh, that's good. That's bracing it for digging. That when you look at a modern vertebrate digging, a modern tetrapod, I should say, when you see it digging, it's going to be bracing itself with its hips and then furiously digging with its forelimbs. So all 3 of those traits, here we had some anatomical traits that also said burrower, in addition to having it in a burrow chamber, in addition to having it in a burrow that also mathematically we figured out was the right size for that size of animal. And then it has these 2 partially grown juveniles in there. They were about 55-60% the size of the adult. So there's denning behavior. So it's not just burrowing, it was denning. Oh, man. Like I said, Christmas on a holiday on your birthday. This was, and a new species of dinosaur. This was something all 3 of us, Dave, Yoshi, and I, we were absolutely delighted to finally, it took a couple of years, but we finally did get it published.
Could I ask you a couple of points about that?
Yeah.
So you say that you've got a new species. How could you be sure that the largest of the specimens in there was the adult if you don't have any of the ontogenetic, like that's the growth range of any other specimens to compare it to?
Yeah, oh no, that's a great question, and it's a great one to ask David Verrecchio. So I suggest you interview David Verrecchio for PaleoCast. Okay, question.
And then the other part of that is, were these specimens found complete?
No, they were incomplete specimens. I think the type specimen, from what I recall, was around 40%. Now, in Dave's defense, I'll say he has other specimens. They found a lot of others that they've identified as at least the same species, certainly the same genus. They even found one a year or two ago in Idaho, so even across the border from Montana. So they've been finding more specimens. They've also found, and Dave, I don't think he's published on this yet, but he has found more partial burrow chambers with more bones in them. So that's something that probably could be done as a bigger paper someday. But he does have more specimens, and I think there is the potential for doing more of a growth series, looking at the ontogenetic sequence in that particular species.
Because the one thing that I was just wanting to rule out is that very close to me here in Manchester, we have a cave deposit known as Windy Knoll, and that's where there was some predator dragging in a whole host of migrating mammals into the cave.
Oh, right.
And so what I wanted to know is it possible that you had another kind of animal in the Cretaceous, say like one of these crocodiles that we know to definitely show burrowing behaviour? Is it possible that they could have just grabbed one of these guys on the outside into their burrow and at them there?
Well, that's where you would, look at more trace fossils, I would say. Because then I would look for tooth marks on the bones, right? And
right.
Absolutely, these are beautifully preserved bones, what's there. Not a complete specimen of the adult, not a complete specimen of either of the 2 juveniles. No tooth marks, absolutely no tooth marks on them. There aren't even any insect marks. There aren't any insect borings on the bones either. So there's no evidence of them having been munched on, noshed on, or otherwise consumed by whether it was a predator or a scavenger. So that's negative evidence. We don't have any evidence of that. It is a possibility we considered. And that's why Dave is also a very good taphonomist. And then he brought me in as an ichnologist. was to look at what were the burrow dimensions versus the dimensions of the animal that we had in the burrow versus, say, the dimensions of a potential predator or scavenger even, that, hey, look, dead body, I'm dragging it back to my den. So alligators do that today. They will scavenge sometimes too, even though they're good predators. So these were considerations we had, but we didn't have any evidence to support that. So we threw it out there. That's a possibility, but with no more evidence to say that, we're not gonna go on that limb any further.
So what do you think it was which actually killed the three critters?
That's a good question, because Dave followed that up with a really cool myth-busting experiment where he had a graduate student, Carrie Woodruff, who put together some PCB piping, made a half-scale model of the Cryptodromius burrow and dent, and then he used some rabbit bones as kind of a proxy for the Cryptodromius bones. So then he did this experiment. I think he did it 13 times he ran it, where he mixed the bones into a slurry of sand and mud that was about the same sort of composition as what was preserved in the rock, and then poured it down this PCV pipe model. And he repeated this experiment. He did it with the bones in the chamber. He did it with the bones outside of the chamber, and came up with a conclusion that, well, it was possible in some of his trials, it was possible that the bones came from outside of the burrow. But it was more likely, because there were so few marks of any kind that he could find of any abrasion or transport of the bones, it's more likely the animals died in the burrow before they got buried. And they got jumbled up and were kind of mixed in with whatever sediment then filled in the burrow chamber. So that's the conclusion so far. So far, so good in terms of that hypothesis. But I really like that here was Dave not sitting on his laurels, being a good scientist, going back, testing that hypothesis even further with some kind of neo-ethnological, neo-taphonomic type of tests.
That's pretty cool. So hypsilophodontids, which Oryctodromus was like a member of, they were usually known for being quite kind of fast and nimble. So why would like Oryctodromus need to burrow or den if, you know, it could probably outrun any of its kind of predators around the time, maybe?
Yeah, no, it's a great question to ask about any sort of animal that, particularly with larger tetrapods. Why did they burrow? What was the advantage in burrowing? Well, number one, protection. That this is a good way, especially if you're raising your young. You're a concerned parent. You're a helicopter parent dinosaur. You want to make sure that your young don't get chomped by one of those nasty, awful theropods out there. So what you do is you have a den. So the den is out of sight, out of mind. Predators are less likely to pick them up, either visually or olfactorily. They won't smell them. They won't see them as easily if they're in this burrow. The burrow, what's kind of cool is it's a twisting burrow. We also see this sort of strategy with gopher tortoises and a fair number of other burrowers that would make tasty treats and are otherwise defenseless. Now, a tortoise versus a Oryctodromius. Yeah, Oryctodromius could have outrun a predator, perhaps. Could its young have outrun a predator? Well, maybe not so easily. So this is where a burrow is really good protection. Secondly, a burrow is going to have good year-round temperature and humidity. It's kind of like being in a cave all year round. It's going to have average temperature, average humidity. It's going to be a very nice, stable environment. So you could get a cold day outside. Let's say we're talking about polar dinosaurs, for instance. A really cold, dark day outside during the winter, your burrow is a nice, stable environment. That's a little better for you to be there. A third form of protection to think about, too, is let's say you get a wildfire. A wildfire, a forest fire, which we have good evidence for happening during the Cretaceous, for instance, pretty ferocious fires. Again, a burrow is going to be very good protection. You might even get some visitors to the burrow when that happens. that's very common today with gopher tortoise burrows here in Georgia is that they get some temporary visitors who say, hey, mind if I hang out in your burrow while this fire goes overhead? And what's kind of nice is for the predators hang out and just wait by the burrow entrance for those little morsels to come out. So that's kind of funny to think about, too. Those burrows being a refuge, but not really for some prey animals. Anyway, you put that all together, there's lots of advantages to being in a burrow other than it's another strategy other than just run away, run away. The Monty Python sort of strategy.
So you mentioned that you get some of these dinosaurs, well, possibly burrowing in polar regions. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that was a paper that I published in 2009 in Cretaceous Research. And I singly authored it because I really didn't want to drag any colleagues into it. Because there was so much that could have gone wrong with that. What I had were some structures that were in early Cretaceous rocks of Victoria. And one structure in particular was almost a dead ringer for what I had seen in Montana with the mid-Cretaceous Blackley Formation burrow that had dinosaur bones at the end of it. This structure that I saw and a couple of other less complete structures that were nearby it was not quite as well expressed as the one in Montana. It also didn't have any bones in it, yet it still had all of the right proportions and overall form and the sedimentology of how it was filled at least twice, for instance, at least two flows filled it, similar to the Eryctodromius burrow. There were graded fills in it. It was in the right sort of facies. It was more of an alluvial facies. There were dinosaur tracks that were nearby it, including the only well-documented small ornithopod track in all of southern Australia was at the site. That's why I was there that day. I was looking actually with a bunch of colleagues from Australia. We were looking for dinosaur tracks that day. All of this put together, I decided to, I better write this up, go ahead and put it out there, put it in the literature. It might get shot down someday. That's fine. I don't care. But I wanted to put it into people's minds. And most of the paper then was about why polar dinosaurs should have burrowed, at least some of them, why some of these smaller ones should have burrowed. Putting it out there as an idea, here's a hypothesis, let's test it, knock it down, and if it is wrong, that's fine. We learned a lot in the process. But again, using modern examples of all of these animals that live at high latitudes today, from puffins to polar bears, that will burrow to overwinter or otherwise get out of the harsh elements of a polar winter.
So we had Australia on the South Pole in the Cretaceous.
That's correct. Yeah, that part of Australia was at about, Victoria. Those rocks, early Cretaceous, they were from about 120 to 105 million years ago. At that time, that part of Australia was still connected to Antarctica, and it was at about 78 degrees paleo latitude, plus or minus 5 degrees. So definitely okay. A polar latitude at that time.
So it was just part of a bigger continent, Australia and Antarctica. But would the dinosaurs have been able to have migrated, or were they pretty much stuck down there on the South Pole?
Yeah, with regard to the debate over whether polar dinosaurs migrated or whether they stayed put, what I did through that study and publishing it in 2009, it was kind of a follow-up to what other people had been asking with regard to high-latitude dinosaurs, particularly the northern latitude ones, where there's a much better fossil record for them, much, much better biodiversity preserved, much better trace fossil record, thousands of tracks of, for instance, of the northern latitude polar dinosaurs versus just the measly few dozen that that I and some of my colleagues found in Australia. So with that fossil record of dinosaurs from polar latitudes, we're asking ourselves, could they have migrated? Was there enough energy available provided by their ecosystems to support that? And so far, the calculations done by Bell and Snively and a few other people, they've looked at this. They've come up with a scenario that the answer is mostly no, that it would have been not worth it energy-wise for these dinosaurs to migrate thousands of kilometers back and forth every year, that just would have been energetically too expensive for them to do that. The ecosystems wouldn't have allowed that, and especially for the small dinosaurs. Think of Troodon, for instance. Troodon's a relatively small theropod. Think of the small ornithopods that were down in Australia. It doesn't make sense for them to, on their two legs, to go migrating thousands of kilometers every year and going back and forth. It made more sense energetically for them to stay put. Well, if they're staying put and they're overwintering, how did they do that? How did they cope with the darkness? How do they cope with the cold? How did they do that? So I threw out there as a possibility, here's one, an adaptation through burrowing. And with the southern latitude dinosaurs, for the smaller ones, here's one possibility for them. So there, it's out there as a hypothesis. It's out there for debate. I want people to try to disprove it. And then we're going to learn a heck of a lot more about polar dinosaurs while testing that, while arguing about it.
Do you think it in any way relates to kind of the amount of sunlight which you get at polar regions? You know, because there's more dark hours, there was more need for burrowing, perhaps?
Yeah, that's a possibility. Yeah, and that gets into, would you use burrows, for instance, for estivation or hibernation, or would it just be, yeah, it's kind of dark and scary out. I think I'm going to hang it in my burrow for a while. Some of us who have been in northern latitudes during the winter, we feel like that. A little bit of denning behavior, but despite our being endotherms. Okay, so that sort of thing can happen too. So it also, again, ties into what I was saying earlier about protection. If you're not adapted for, say, low light conditions, there might be predators out there that are adapted for low light conditions and you're not. So actually, yeah, that's a pretty neat other possibility to think about. Is there's been some research done recently looking at the orbits of dinosaur skulls and asking these really good questions about how well could they see in the light, how well could they see in the dark. Were these diurnal dinosaurs, were these nocturnal dinosaurs, or were they more crepuscular? Those are really cool questions to ask from body fossils. But here's something where I say, ooh, here's where trace fossils might tie into that too.
I think that study actually found that Troodon did have the largest orbit, the sclerotic ring in the orbit was actually the largest out of all theropods, pretty much. That would be good evidence for it being adapted to low light conditions like that.
Right, and Lielinosaura, which is a small ornithopod from southern Australia, from rocks of exactly the same age as where I found these purported dinosaur burrows. Lielinosaura also had proportionally large orbits in the one skull that's been found, and also the endocast of the skull had an enlarged optic lobe interpreted by Patricia Vickers-Rich and Tom Rich and others. So in that instance, they were also saying this was a dinosaur adapted for low light conditions. But if you think about it, if it had predators out there in polar Australia and it's dark, it needed more advantages because it otherwise was a defenseless dinosaur against any sort of predator.
I love the idea that it's almost like convergent evolution in two, vaguely different groups, you know, both catching on like this kind of adaptation, which will help them either survive or eat better. Using it for different reasons, and it's quite cool, actually.
Yeah, and it's also cool to think about, here's where we can use multiple lines of reasoning, because I always want to bring it back to ichnology, is how lines of reasoning, let's bring in the trace fossil evidence and ask ourselves, how could trace fossils also address some of these questions? For instance, in my tracking of modern animals, I'm kind of interested in how do certain animals, like mammals and birds, for instance, that behave more, say, at night versus the day. With birds, modern theropods, modern dinosaurs, for instance, there are some birds that they just hunt at night. Yellow-crowned night herons, for instance. I've tracked them many times. wonderful predators, absolutely wonderful predators. Down in the Caribbean and the Bahamas, when I've tracked them, it's really cool to follow their tracks and watch them on the hunt for these land crabs. But they're always out at night. That's when they do their hunting. So that's when their tracks are being made. Contrast that then with, say, some of their close relatives, like great blue herons or egrets, that here they are. They're theropod dinosaurs too. They're modern feathered dinosaurs. They're out there. They're hunting. They're doing all their hunting during the day. So how do their tracks look different? How does the hunting style differ? I don't have an answer for that yet, but there's a clue for how we could start addressing some of those behaviors of how we could interpret, say, theropod dinosaur behavior, that we're interpreting this dinosaur based on its anatomy as being nocturnal. I say, okay, let's look at trace fossils then and see, do trace fossils we attribute to those kind of dinosaurs, say certain types of dromaeosaurs, could those have been made at night? Ooh, you tell that. That's a cool question, I think, to ask in ichnology.
And that's it for the script, unless we want to go off on some other tangent.
I do want to go off on a little tangent.
All right, great. Tangent away.
Well, yeah, tangents are cool. Pretty much, it's just, can you tell us about your secret weapon of public communication?
Yeah, the main secret weapon I use, and I think people, it's going to be evident, I think, a little bit in this paleocast, can I use that term, is humor. And one of the tools I've used in my humor in the last few years has been paleontologist Barbie. And a lot of people, they do know about paleontologist Barbie. There are different types of Barbies, for instance. But then there was one that came out about the time of Jurassic Park in the 1990s. And it's paleontologist Barbie dressed up in what Mattel thought was paleontologist garb. And of course, it was totally inappropriate garb. And many of my female paleontologist colleagues have chuckled quite a bit about it. But they have collected the doll and they absolutely love the doll. I always wanted one because I love the idea of using one as scale in a photograph. And I'd done that a few times, borrowed some of my paleontological colleagues, paleontologist Barbies, use them as scale in photographs where she's pointing to a trace fossil with an extreme close-up of an invertebrate burrow, and there she is pointing to it. And it's always gotten good laughs whenever I've done that in a talk, at a professional meeting, of course. But I lacked my own paleontologist Barbie. So my wife, Ruth, came to the rescue. She got me one on eBay, and what I love about this paleontologist Barbie, she's also, I think she was meant to be an African-American paleontologist Barbie. So she kind of looks like most of the world in that respect. So I love her also as kind of this positive affirming role model. And I've kind of rebooted her as this action hero, kind of if you combined, Laura Croft and whoever else you might think of.
Alan Grant.
Yeah. And I often call her the honey badger of paleontologists. So when I've done pictures of her, I often have, I put these on Facebook as public album, where she's in action, she's in the field, and she's really smart, and she's really good at math, and she's going, this is great, I love it, bring it on. That I think is a really fun way to communicate science, communicate paleontology, doing it very tongue-in-cheek, but also doing it through kind of affirming positive role models. My wife helps co-script it with me too. And she's also done through her blog interviews with paleontologists. And what is paleontologist Barbie is this renaissance gal. She loves art, she's interested in science. How do they combine? It's just all so fascinating. So through this, we've been able, I think, to do some really fun science communication. So in kind of to sum it up, my secret weapon is not so much paleontologist Barbie, it's using humor, using fun, using levity and enthusiasm for communicating science to a public that really grabs onto it when you present it in that way.
Do you find that, you know, it does work pretty well?
Oh, it works really well. And
what, compared to something like a boring linear podcaster?
let me enumerate the 10 points I have here on the slide. Let me read it for you word by word. Oh, did you want a picture to go with that? I don't think so. Next slide. Okay, the next 10 points I have in my conclusions. No, I don't do that. Okay. So the talk that I gave a little over a month ago, you guys would have loved this one, the Atlanta Science Tavern. We have this wonderful, thriving group of science enthusiasts here in Atlanta, Georgia, that I just absolutely love. They've had me back 3 times now to talk with them because I'm their ideal speaker. I drink a beer during my talk. So they've been so impressed by that. They invited me back a 3rd time. I talked about my book. And in the middle of the talk, and that's key, in the middle of the talk, that's when paleontologist Barbie appears. And several of them commented to me afterwards. They absolutely loved that I injected that sort of humor in there in the middle of the talk. We also brought her to the Science Tavern that night. So my wife held her up and, she, you know, paleontologist Barbie, the doll, was waving to the crowd. So that was memorable. That was really memorable. And people did thank me for it. They said that that made them, I think, remember the evening better in a way, despite the beer.
Wow. That's really awesome. Maybe we need to get a European version of her.
Yeah, that's right. So I look forward to doing that sometime with a European audience.
That'd be cool. Are you going to the European Geoscience Union annual general meeting, actually? Is something on your radar?
Oh, well, I don't know. All I need to do is get invited and people buy me beer and I'm it's more likely I'm going to show up.
Okay.
Think about it.
Fair enough.
Wherever there are trace fossils and beer, I will go. Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it, Dave. Really appreciate it, John. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tony. You've been amazing.
And the opportunity for doing this sort of outreach. I love doing this. Thank you.
So what did you make of all that, man, Dave?
Well, not knowing much about dinosaurs, it was pretty enlightening that you can have them burrowing. It was never something that I ever imagined, to be honest. Dinosaurs have always been walking around in like either a desert or a forest. They've never been on the South Pole in a little hole.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. They appear to have occupied quite a wide range of habitats, and it's actually quite reflected in their morphology in a lot of cases. So they're very cool. I think one of the things which stuck out for me is the kind of holistic scientific framework which you need in order to do like a proper ichnological analysis. Like, you know, it's not just looking at trace fossils, looking at the sedimentology, the local fossils in a particular region, the plant life, the insect life, the big dinosaur-y type things, and as well as that, looking at kind of the modern neo-ecology of organisms to see if we can interpret that and kind of create this whole ecosystem overview, you know, which trace fossils are somewhat informing, and, you know, create like a living, breathing system.
Yeah, as Tony said, it is pretty much crime scene investigation more than study of the body fossils can be.
Do you know, for that, we totally have to play the CSI theme tune as the outro.
I don't know if we have it.
You can just rip it off YouTube.
I've never watched CSI. Is it any good?
Nope.
Right, I'll see you next time.
Okay, au revoir.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.